Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, and we are going to celebrate! Where are the whistles and the noisemakers? 125 years for anti-cruelty. That's incredible.
Dr. Sheila Robertson is one of the leaders in this industry of veterinary medicine. You are about to receive a very prestigious award for animal welfare from the American Veterinary Medical Association. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a huge honor. So I'm quite excited to be here and give my acceptance speech and give a lecture on how pain management in cats has been transformed since I started as a veterinarian, which I have to admit is over 40 years ago. So I've seen a lot of changes.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of that. Right. Am I going to be in your speech? I'm not mentioned in the speech?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, darn it. I thought for sure. So, yes, in the time you've been a veterinarian, I think when you started, and you can tell me, pain was barely even accepted. We didn't even think that somehow dogs and cats could even be in pain.
Yeah, so I graduated in 1980, and at that time, even in small children, they would do surgery without the benefit of analgesics or pain,
really?
Pain medication.
Even in children?
Even in children.
They Is that were because they weren't available? Or
No, they were available, but they felt that these babies were too delicate to, you know, withstand the effects of the drugs. But then what actually happened was a mother whose newborn son had undergone some major surgery without the benefit of analgesics. They used to just give them muscle relaxants. And her son died. And she truly believed that her son died from the pain and that he could have benefited from the drugs.
You die from pain?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Yes, you can.
And if it's true for me and you, it would be true for our dogs and cats, I would imagine.
Yep. And so she led a campaign and got some just amazing pediatric surgeons and anesthesiologists on board, and they started using these drugs, like analgesics, in the babies and found that it didn't harm them and that they could sail through their surgery and, you know, heal very, very well with the benefit of pain medication.
So how about for dogs and cats? At what point was it accepted that, yes, our animals can suffer pain as well?
Yeah, it was, you know, it's been a long, slow process to, you know, people thought, well, animals don't feel pain. That used to be where the end of the sentence was.
And then it was hard to even believe that that scientists believe that.
Well, some didn't, and that's the good thing. And so then it became animals don't feel pain in the same way as humans, but they did feel it. And our duty was to figure out how did we know that they hurt? Like, what did they can't speak to us. Mm-hmm. So we had to, discern, like, what do they do when they're painful? So we started looking at behavior and facial expressions, and it was clear that they were telling us, but through body language and facial expressions, how they felt.
But if I close the door and my dog's tail is under the door, my dog's going to yelp.
Yep.
How can we think that dogs can't be in pain? I don't even comprehend.
Yeah, it's now looking back, but when I was a veterinarian in the 80s and I was determined to give, analgesics to my patients, people used to raise their eyebrows and go, okay, good luck, people started seeing the benefits. Like the very first drug that I ever used as a potent analgesic was morphine, because it was one of the first opioids that we had access to. So I used, I gave morphine to animals despite, the urban legend that, morphine mania, you give morphine to cats and they get all excited. And that was from very, very old studies where they were using inappropriate dosing. But once we figured it out, people were like, oh, that's that kind of really does make a difference. And then, people just got excited about the fact that we could help these animals and obviously realized that they had been, not recognizing the pain.
Well, and today we know that their neurochemistry, that little the soup they have in their heads, is pretty much identical to ours. So they've got to feel all sorts of things, including pain, but not limited to pain.
Correct.
About the same as we. They may express it differently. A canine is going to express anything differently than a chimpanzee, which would express it differently than a dolphin. But it doesn't mean they don't feel those things.
I mean, their expression of pain is very species-specific, the behaviors.
Right. Yeah.
But the anatomy, like the pain pathway, so to speak, is pretty much identical in all mammals.
Which we now understand better. So for a while, we've been able to help dogs a bit more than cats because, and you tell me if this is true, and I'm talking about acute pain primarily.
Yeah, I think always the research on cats has lagged a little bit behind dogs, but I would say it's, you know, the research and the drugs that have come to our toolbox that are approved, you know, FDA-approved drugs for cats, has just escalated in the last 10 years. So we now have a lot of really good approved drugs that we know have great efficacy in our cat toolbox.
But the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, well, they can work for cats, not all cats all the time. Is that true?
Yeah, well, we have some that are approved by the FDA for short-term use in the U.S. and some that are approved for long-term use in other countries. And so it just depends on where you live, whether it's an approved use. But certainly there's a reluctance by some people to use non-steroidals in older cats, especially if they have kidney disease.
And a lot of older cats have kidney disease.
And a lot of older cats have kidney disease, yeah.
However, there's new information, or at least something new out there. We'll talk about what that new product is, that it doesn't seem to matter if that cat has kidney disease. We will talk about that when we come back on WGN. Dr. Sheila Robertson is boarded in veterinary medicine in everything. Tell me about that.
No, so what I specialized in is anesthesia and pain management, but also animal welfare. And so I've trained both in Europe and mostly in the United Kingdom, but also here in the U.S. So I'm board certified in both the colleges of animal welfare and anesthesia and pain management here and in Europe.
Are you the only one?
There
can't be many.
There's not many of us, no.
Yeah. I know one veterinary behaviorist who beats you just a little bit. She's boarded in behavior in Australia, in Europe, and in America.
Okay, that's a triple.
I know. Yeah, she doesn't work hard or anything. So talk to me about cats and arthritis. It was thought that because cats are not big, that they can't have arthritis, but that turns out, or at least not as often as dogs, turns out not to be true.
Absolutely not true. We've just overlooked it because a lot of cats, when they do get arthritis, so they get pain in their joints, they get pain in multiple joints. So both the left and the right side is affected, so they don't look as if they're limping because they're equally affected, whereas a dog usually gets one joint that's more affected, so they limp, and it's like obvious to the owner. Cats rarely have a limp. And the other thing is, we're not usually taking our cat out for a walk in the evening and realizing that, like dogs, they're like, they don't want to go as far, they want to rest more. That's a clue to the owner. With cats, you know, they're a little more subtle about their problems. But what we can really tell now that we know they have a disease that causes mobility impairment is that if you quiz owners or ask them the right questions, what you find out is the cat is no longer jumping on the counter, no longer using the cat tree, reluctant to go downstairs, and that's all because it hurts to move, you know, jump up or jump down. So now we're learning that, yes, they have the disease.
It isn't because after 10 years I have finally trained my cat to keep off the counters?
No, it's kind of a hard one to break to owners when when they tell you that they've managed to train the cat not to jump up. It's like, oops, let's see how painful his joints are.
Yes, and you can do that now. That's the other thing about technology. There are ways in which you can do that. So there's two things. First of all, owner assessments. There are tools for all of you, pet parents, and these clues can be so subtle for cats. You mentioned a couple, not jumping up on the counters, but sometimes even the way in which a cat goes up and down stairs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, cats usually, you know, run up and down, and they're very fluid in their movements and everything. But when they have arthritis, you can see them hesitating, or like sometimes they'll do what looks like a bunny hop.
Yeah.
And that's just not a normal cat.
Yeah. Or what I tell people to do is from the age of 5 or whatever that random age is, to videotape their cat jumping up and down, just things that they do every day. Yep. It might be on your bed, it might be on a counter, whatever that is. But do it in slow motion.
Yep, that's what I do with a lot of the owner videos. I, you know, have them send me a video clip, and then I slow it down to half speed.
Tell me why I'm saying that.
Yeah, because what you often see is one of the most, I think, reasons I look at them in slow motion is that a lot of people think their cat is jumping off the couch or jumping off the bed or jumping off the counter. And when you look at it in slow motion, they're actually sliding off. They're sliding down because they want to make that landing not as, you know, dramatic as if jumping off from 6 feet down to the floor like they would when they were a year old. What they do is they kind of slide down as far as they can, and then they get on the floor. And you can, it's so obvious when you see it in a video. And now we have artificial intelligence now that we can feed these videos into an AI system, and it can interpret the movements and tell whether it's a cat with a mobility impairment or a cat that's moving just the way it should.
Wow. That last part, I didn't know. I didn't know that was being done.
Yeah, it's being developed. And so at the moment, it can analyze cats jumping up and down off a step. They're developing it to interpret, you know, normal versus abnormal movement.
So two questions for you. First, do you think that you have, as a practitioner, a point of comparison? So if I have a cat and I take the video of the cat jumping up and down or the same place and then walking up and down stairs, same place, because I don't move, I don't change households, it's the same place, and I show you at the age of 5 and 6 and 7 and on, you have a point of comparison for that individual cat, but also then the pet parent can see what the difference is. Is that of value?
It's of huge value. I mean, I would say even starting at the age of 2, because there are some cats under the age of 5 that have the disease. So starting at the age of 2, when they're coming for a veterinary visit, they should get a little reminder. We should have the owners take a video clip of, you know, all we need is like 30 seconds. That's plenty of time. Jumping up, jumping down, using stairs, you know, even getting up from sleeping. Like, do they stretch? Do they, you know, how do they get up and down? And then just date stamp it.
Yes.
And then catalog it and let us have a copy, and they can keep a copy. And then you can see how things change over time. But what's most exciting is when we get those cats and the owners seek our help to help treat them, we can see them reversing back to the way they were. Like, maybe not all the way back to when they were, you know, 1 or 2, but you can see an improvement. And one of the, I wouldn't say it's a complaint, but it's sort of a complaint. It's kind of a joke. Owners say, oh, yes, now I'm finding, like, plants getting knocked off the top shelf, which have been safe for years.
Sure.
But the cats are now going back up and knocking things off shelves, which they haven't done in years. And it's kind of funny, actually. Yeah.
But now there's a new game changer that's available for cats, specifically for cats, only for cats.
Yeah. So this is, it's called it's a monoclonal antibody. So it's like, it's a biologic. So it's not actually a drug. It's a protein that can mop up the key driver of pain in the joints. So it's an anti-nerve growth factor monoclonal antibody, and we give it once a month under the skin. And the responses I've seen are just game-changing. It's just so impressive to see these animals getting their mobility back, and even their behavior and their personality just pops right back. And you realize that they've been a little bit reclusive because of their pain, and they just shine through again.
And it's also about reestablishing the human-animal bond. So people, when things happen gradually, it's hard to notice. So if, let's say, I always had a cuddly cat, and every day that cat cuddles with me when I watch a reality show. I don't really watch reality shows, but let's say I did. And then I don't know, after a couple of years of that, maybe 4 days a week the cat does it. Or the cat does it for a shorter period of time. And very, very gradually, that cat's not spending that same time with me. It's actually sometimes hard for pet parents to notice the difference.
Yep. Yeah, it's just they're just like people. If anyone listening in has chronic pain, you just know you're not as sociable. You don't want to do things. You just, you know, because you're constantly, you know, engaged in your pain. And so the cats are just, retreating because they're painful. You might find that they don't like to be petted. They don't like to be groomed. And that's because it feels uncomfortable because they're painful.
And that's often mistaken for being grumpy because they're old or a behavior problem or any number of things that we now understand. They're just in pain.
Yeah. So any behavioral issue that that an owner brings a cat to me with, the first thing we do is evaluate for pain. And so many behavioral issues, like not using a litter box, isn't necessarily like, oh boy, you know, we've got a problem. It's like, oh, it's painful and it can't climb into the litter box that you have provided. Treat the pain, that problem goes away. So lots of behavior is due to pain.
Yeah. More than one might think, I would believe.
A lot more.
So the notion of the litter boxes of what you just said, and that can be life and death. Because sometimes cats are relinquished because they are thinking outside the box. It could be a cat that's at 3 a.m. yowling.
Yep.
And there's all these explanations you can read online, and some of these are probably true. However, it could be that the cat is just painful. Any number, it could be mouth pain, dental pain.
Yep.
But it can also be osteoarthritis. The cat just moved the wrong way in its sleep, and now it hurt, you know?
Yep. So the first thing we do is treat pain and see if that reverses that behavior that, you know, we don't want. And, you know, we do some modification, like we, you know, help people, like, design a better litter box, a low-entry litter box. But usually when you treat the pain, the cat is quite happy to go back to the litter box and, you know, how it used to, because it doesn't hurt to clamber in and clamber out.
She's an expert in animal welfare. You can hear why. And a winner. The winner of the American Veterinary Medical Association. They give this award out only once a year, you know.
Yeah.
So there's how many veterinarians? Only one receives the award every year. This year, it's you. Congratulations. So deserved. Thank you.
Thank you.
So imagine going to an event, and you can do this virtually. In fact, that's the only way to do it, where you hear some of the greatest experts talk about dog behavior on the planet. Victoria Stilwell from It's Me or the Dog on Animal Planet has brought all of these amazing people together, and it isn't particularly expensive to attend. And once you are registered, you don't have to hear everybody this entire weekend of the event. You can watch later. Watch is the right word, on your computer. It's incredible what she's done. We're also going to talk to Victoria, or at least I want to talk to her about what's going on in San Francisco. Will they ban electronic collars, e-collars? She is a proponent. I am a strong proponent of that as well. That is all next week. I love it when Victoria Stilwell stops by, and she will, right here on WGN. He is the president of the Anti-Cruelty Society of Chicago, Chicago's oldest animal shelter. I would argue not only oldest, but maybe the facility that does the most, which is what matters most, looking into the crystal ball. But boy, the history this place holds. There was a benefit last night. It was incredible to learn, Tracy, about some of that history.
Thank you, Steve, for having me on. And more importantly, thank you for helping us mark this occasion. You know, it's rare that any organization reaches 125 years. I look back in history and try to get a sense of what Chicago was like in 1899 when Rose Faye Thomas and her friends started this organization. And it was a period of the fastest growth of the city in its history. And all kinds of phenomenal organizations were being founded. I mean, we grew after the fire, like, you know, just like, well, no pun intended, like wildfire.
Uh-oh.
But, you know, Sears, Montgomery Ward, the symphony orchestra, several of the museums, the library, Hull House, you know, at Jane Addams organization, we were literally growing at the fastest pace in our history. And of course, what that meant was that there were about 50,000 horses pulling wagons, police cars, ambulances, whatever on the streets. And they were horribly treated. They were looked at as, you know, useful machines as long as they were useful. And Rose Faye Thomas was the wife of the founder of the CSO and the first maestro. And so she was a society woman. They had money. She didn't have to do anything but sit back and enjoy her society life. But she couldn't stand to see what was happening to those horses. So she started this organization.
Wow.
And it began by trying to help, you know, care for horses, putting literally putting, you know, water tanks out and blankets and then a place for them to go when they retire so they weren't just shot. And but of course the automobile came soon and cars went away and the city grew like crazy. And then there were all kinds of stray dogs and cat communities as well. And so the organization transitioned to more of what it like is like today, and began to rescue, rehabilitate, and rehome homeless animals, and also provide veterinary care. 1936 was the first veterinary clinic, one of the first in the country, that was either low cost or no cost. And it's just been a remarkable story since then. And we're going to make sure it's remarkable for the next era of the organization as well.
Here's an impossible question for you to answer. And I don't mean to put you on the spot. Do you have any idea how many dogs and cats have been saved since the Anti-Cruelty Society began? Which, by the way, at the very beginning, you mentioned it was primarily horses. But do you have any idea?
Data, unfortunately, doesn't go back that far. But we've done some extrapolation. We found an article in the Tribune that was 1909. And interestingly enough, the Chicago City Council was considering a bill that would not allow any euthanasia of animals at all. Isn't that amazing? 1909. Hmm. So Rose Faye Thomas, you know, took charge and said it's horrible to allow all these animals to die of exposure and of hunger. And they shared an amazing statistic. I don't know how this is possible with the facility, but this is in the Tribune. The intake that year, 1909, was 30,000 animals.
Wow.
The only other data they gave is 2,500 were adopted. So that doesn't sound good, right? And so if we were adopting out about 2,500 animals then, and we're in the 4,000 to 5,000, occasionally 6,000 now, you can kind of do the math. And, you know, we don't know the trajectory of how quickly it grew, but it's been, but you know, obviously between that for, that was in 1909, so not quite 125 years, but let's just say 120 years, maybe 115. That's a lot of animals. It also, sadly, is a lot of animals that there was no space for. There was nothing to do with at that time. And that's the great news, is that the entire community, in fact, the entire country, has moved so far towards, first of all, reducing homelessness by spay-neuter, by changing the culture, and then being able to handle the volume of animals coming in and only euthanize when there's no other humane option, when they are too ill or too behaviorally damaged to be able to live successfully with humans and safely with humans. So we've come a long, long way. And, you know, on our all of this anniversary is about celebrating that history and that progress, which is remarkable. And it's not Anti-Cruelty's progress. It's the entire city's progress, because there are a lot of other people doing this. Plus, it required, you know, government to get involved. It required phenomenal efforts at spay-neuter, changing the culture that animals are actually worth being cared for, treated humanely. They're not things. They have, you know, both feelings and feel pain, and we have a responsibility to treat them humanely. And you've been a big part of that, Steve, for a very long time, of changing that culture, right? As an advocate, and there were lots of advocates like you that got this job done.
Well, thank you for the shout out, but I would argue, you know, who leads the shelters, including Anti-Cruelty? It is the team of volunteers that has always been there from the very start.
That is the truth. We have volunteers, Steve, that have been volunteering here steadily for over 30 years. And we have about 500-600 active volunteers in any year, but on our volunteer books, you know, people can call and activate if we need them or they want to. It's thousands. I think that's the benefit of the legacy of the organization. We have employees who have been here 40 years. We have volunteers in the 30-year range. But we also have this constant influx, obviously, of new people, new energy, new ideas. And it's a great balance of being a legacy organization, but one that is not sitting on its laurels, right? We could easily just relax.
Oh, no, 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 no. You, I know very well, are not doing that. And by the way, in an industry that there is constant turnover for a variety of different reasons, to say that you have volunteers and staff members that have been there over a decade, let alone longer than that, speaks right. volumes of anti-cruelty. It's, just that alone from a human perspective. Now, right, what we didn't give was a number, and we're talking thousands, countless thousands of dogs and cats and other species that have been saved and going way back, horses. I mean, the legacy is more than impressive, and I think Chicago realizes that, and you celebrated that officially, actually, a couple of days ago, where you had a party in-house. I happened to be there, and all sorts of good things happened for anti-cruelty. And we'll talk about what some of those good things are, what the future looks like, celebrating anti-cruelty, and what this organization for 125 years has been doing for the community, for all of us in Chicago, when we come back. Tracy Elliott is the president of Anti-Cruelty, and in fact, 125 years. What an anniversary, what a celebration, and it really began, in a sense, not at your big gala, fancy event, but a couple of days ago at the facility itself. Tell me about some of what happened there.
Well, it was just amazing. Steve, I forgot to mention the number, but conservatively, we think that over that 115 to 20 years that we've been dealing with companion animals, we probably served about 345,000 animals.
Hmm. Wow.
That's a conservative guess using averaging of what we do know. But back to the 7th. The 7th was, in fact, the 125th anniversary. So we had a wonderful celebration here where we revealed a brand new logo and a brand new brand that is updated, fresh, and puts us ready to head, you know, into the future. But way more importantly, we redid, renovated, and upgraded our animal holding areas, particularly our dog holding areas up on the third floor, which were quite behind the times. And they are now as stress-free as it's possible. There are building standards and design standards that reduce the amount of stress that an animal feels in a particular space. And we've completely transformed them. We now have, instead of a caged environment for our cat adoption room, it's a roaming environment. We have three free roaming rooms. We now actually have four because we had one before, and potentially five if we use it for cats. So that most of our cats, if they're behaving well, and you know, cats behave well sometimes and sometimes they don't, kind of like people.
Yes, it's like people.
You can now go in and enjoy, you know, a number of cats in a room that are free roaming and may want to come up and deal with you or may want to take a nap. But it actually, as you know, Steve, the science is that is a less stressful environment for them than being alone in a cage, reduces disease, and also decreases the days in shelter, increases the adoption rate, as well as a more stress-free environment for dogs does the same thing. So we put a lot of money, thanks to generous donors, into the building to really make sure the animal areas are top-notch. But we also transformed our lobby into a welcome center. This neighborhood, as you know, is going through a transition, and it's becoming kind of an experiential center instead of a retail center. You know, there's the ice cream museum and all the other kinds of experiences. We want people to come in here and experience the beauty and the power of the human-animal bond. So we've developed a welcoming center. It's just the start. We have a lot more to do in terms of programming to get people in. but it's going to be a really pleasant, wonderful, beautiful space, a lot more open areas for people to congregate. And we're really, really pleased. And we're happy to show anybody this if you want to stop by and take a tour. We did tours that day. As I said, we revealed the logo. And then the other great thing that happened was the city declared the street to be Honorary Rose Faye Thomas Way.
Wow.
Rose Faye Thomas was the
founder. Is there anyone from her family still around?
No, they were childless.
Yeah.
So we don't
if she
know.
Only, yeah, that's why I saw no one from, but if they only knew, you know, that's amazing. So you're not at LaSalle and Grand anymore?
We are LaSalle and Grand. We're at LaSalle and Rose Faye Thomas Way.
Yeah, there you go. That's amazing. And there were public officials out to celebrate.
That's right. We have to thank Alderman Riley for that. He championed that for us through the city council, and thank the mayor for signing it. We appreciate that very much. And he was here to do the unveiling.
Of course. Now, at the Fancy Gala, you honored Andy Avalos for all his years. Remember from Channel 5? Yeah, way back when, but not that far back, when he delivered weather for all of Chicago. But he also delivered adoptable animals and was a huge supporter. MC'd several benefits together, a huge supporter of anti-cruelty. And another one that you celebrated that I'll let you chat about, my friend, Dr. Shelley Rubin.
Well, what can one say about Dr. Rubin? He has been on our board for, we think, 40 years. Nobody really remembers. he's an absolute monumental figure in the history of this organization. He helped us develop, you know, significantly improved and expanded veterinary services here on site. We have an animal hospital, a completely up-to-date, state-of-the-art animal hospital on site. Dr. Rubin was significantly involved in that project. He's done volunteer veterinary work for us. He's come in and done spay-neuter surgeries on his time off and after retirement. Yeah, he's you know, one of the best-known vets in probably in the history of the city. Thousands of people just love him, the way he treated their animals. So
indeed,
we honored him. Yeah, we named our Volunteer of the Year award after him.
Wow.
But we gave him the first one because he's the volunteer of the, let's see, four decades.
Yeah.
Not just of a year.
Yeah. The thing also about Dr. Rubin is he really has been a visionary. Having nothing directly to do with anti-cruelty, he is the guy who said, we need an emergency facility open 24/7 in Chicago for pets. And most cities, I don't know, it could have been the first in the country. I honestly don't know, but it was one of the first. And it was Dr. Rubin's vision. The whole notion today of fear-free, which he merits no credit for, but in a sense, he had been doing that his entire career. The way is a diagnostician, and I've talked about this in many different platforms, and I will as long as I can. I've never met a veterinarian quite like him in that sense, but also the way he understood the human-animal bond before it was even really talked about. The fact that he was on Wally Phillips' show here on WGN Radio for years talking about the bond before other veterinarians did just that. So we have literally 2 minutes left here. Tracy, let's look into the crystal ball. Not necessarily 40 years down the road, just this year, next year, the year after. What are some of the things that anti-cruelty is going to be focusing on?
We're going to be focusing on taking the services that we have provided here at this location for basically 125 years, but mostly wellness care, veterinary care, which has become incredibly expensive, connection to animal services. And we're going to be taking those into the greater Roseland community. And then expanded beyond that. So we have something called the Roseland Immersion Project, which is to get us down into the Roseland community. We're already down there knocking on doors, providing support for families. But we're going in a much bigger way in the next couple of years. We will have a facility down there. It will start small. but it will grow. We will have a veterinary medical unit, a mobile medical unit, and then eventually a medical facility down there. And we really want to make a huge difference in that community. The human-animal bond can heal a lot of wounds, not only with people, with families, but also with communities. We believe that, and that's what we're going to be focusing on. We're going to continue to do what we do here and do it better and better every day. But it's time to get out into the community, taking our services to people who need them. And that's the next era.
And the truth is that, and you kind of slid over this, anti-cruelty has been doing that for a very long time, but now in a more prominent way. The other great news is that during the pandemic, more people in more parts of the city, not only Chicago, all over the country, adopted pets. But there are veterinary deserts in many parts of Chicago, and this is a way to affordably rectify that?
Absolutely. There are veterinary deserts, but even where there are not, for certain folks, even working class people who have jobs and have incomes, it's just become too expensive. Particularly, it's kind of like going to the auto mechanic and praying that it isn't $1,000, right?
Yeah.
But it always is.
Yeah.
People go to the vet now, or the dentist, and their teeth chatter because they're like, what's the bill going to be, and can I afford it, and what do I have to give up, right? People have to make heartbreaking decisions to break that bond and surrender those animals. And we never want that to happen for someone who loves and wants to care for their animals. But
indeed.
Just need help.
Yep.
We're going to be there to help.
Well, and you have been for 125 years. You, Tracy, are a part of the story now. And frankly, from someone who's been on the sidelines for a long time, a huge part of that story. Thank you for everything.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for everything you do and that your staff does for the companion animals and for our families every single day. Happy anniversary.
Thank you, sir.
A hoot and a holler to ya for a nation that's just under 33,000 square miles. Ireland has more than a wee bit share of St. Patrick's Day dogs. Just to compare, Ireland is slightly smaller than the state of Maine. We have a handful of dogs that were born in America. They have, well, nine dog breeds. The Glen of Amal Terrier. That's one of those dogs that's longer than it is tall. The Irish Red and White Setter. So we hear about Irish setters and other setters too, such as the Gordon Setter or the English Setter. Those are the others. We don't hear about the Irish Red and White that often, and it is not only a beautiful dog, they are great dogs to have. Speaking of beautiful dogs, the Irish Setter, one of the most regal and easily identifiable of all dog breeds. That mahogany coat is just gorgeous, right? And they date back to the 16th century. The Irish Water Spaniel. That dog has been around, or at least the breed has, for about 1,000 years. According to Irish folklore, the breed was a descendant of the Dobberhow Chew, a breed that is long gone, but the Irish Water Spaniel, which, by the way, has webbed paws, is still around. And yes, they love water, and some people with allergies can actually do well with this breed. From the county of Cork, it's hard to imagine a breed more Irish than the Irish Terrier, right? They are a breed that has an opinion about things always. They could host their own talk show. At about 31 inches long, potentially standing at 6 feet tall on its hind legs, here comes the Irish Wolfhound. We know the American Beagle. There's one from Ireland, too, called the Kerry Beagle. And then there are the Kerry Blue Terriers, soft-coated Wheaton Terriers, and those are the breeds from Ireland. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.